It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Women have played an outsized role in elections for decades.
According to the Center for American Women in Politics, women have registered and voted at higher rates than men in every presidential election since 1980.
In 2020, there were nearly 10 million more female voters than male ones.
How are groups looking to build and leverage the strength of this voting bloc here in Wisconsin?
We had hoped to talk with leaders from organizing groups on opposing sides of the ideological spectrum here in the state. We tried, but were unable to schedule an interview with the conservative parental rights group Moms for Liberty.
We are joined now, however, by Danielle Scampini-Lynn of Elm Grove. She's a founding member of the progressive-leaning group Motherhood for Good. Danielle, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thanks so much, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Your organization, Motherhood for Good, has only been around a couple of years. Could you tell us just what motivated you to help found it?
Yes, definitely. So I got involved with the team that is now Motherhood for Good back in the summer of 2022 while I was actually on maternity leave with my son, who is now just turned two. Mm-hmm. At the time, we were Moms for Mandela, and we were working to get Mandela Barnes elected to the Senate, which unfortunately it did not go our way, but we really built this strong coalition, and it felt like we had tapped into a group that had not necessarily been focused on or prioritized in, you know, progressive leaning moms and other caregivers of young and youngish children. And so we felt like even though that didn't go our way, the work was absolutely not done and we needed to take that momentum and run with it. And so some of us who had been kind of on the leadership team for Moms for Mandela created Motherhood for Good. And then, you know, right after that, we had the Supreme Court race in Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and we really just kind of hit the ground running with that. And then it has just kind of snowballed into what it is today.
Why coalesce around moms in particular or people with children? What is it about these types of voters?
You know, the thing that we always say is that we advocate for our kids in so many different areas of life. We advocate for them, you know, at school and in the doctor's office. And we want to make sure that they are growing up in a world that is safe and gives them all the opportunities that they could have, and that they are becoming these people who we want to see in society. And so for so long, we were told, keep politics out of it, because it's not polite to talk politics. It's not, you know, politics, religion. These aren't the things that we talk about, you know, in polite society. And we really wanted to turn that on its head, because if you advocate for your kids in all these different areas of life, why wouldn't you advocate for them in politics? Because that is going to be one of the biggest things. Like, public policy is going to shape their lives in such a dramatic way. You've got to be advocating for them in this space.
In this space, does your party matter? I mean, when you look at the policy goals that you're prioritizing, does it matter which party supports these goals?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, for so long, I also think that the Republican Party has had, or even just conservatives in general, have had kind of the image of being the party of family values. And when you really look at what my family values are and the family values of so many people in that same community of people raising young kids in America today, the things that I care about: strong public schools, affordable childcare, common sense gun laws, making sure my kids are safe at school, literally safe, you know, from an actual physical threat, not safe from some demagoguing of a book that someone is worried that they might be reading. You know, I want to make sure that my kids have a clean, healthy planet to live on, that they grow up having the same amount, if not more, reproductive rights and freedoms that I grew up with. It's just all of those things, when you line them up, very clearly align to the Democratic Party or progressive leaning policies. And when I look at the other side, I truly don't see what about their platform is pro-family if it's not all of those things.
Hmm. How has your work changed since President Biden dropped out of the race and Vice President Kamala Harris has become the nominee, Democratic nominee?
I mean, if you told me 2 months ago that we would be where we are right now, I wouldn't even comprehend how we got here. A month ago, even. It feels like this is the way. It feels like a completely new campaign, right? Mm-hmm. It's like we don't even remember what it was like a couple weeks ago because the shift has been so dramatic. You know, we were always going to be supportive of the candidate who supports all of those things that I just mentioned, all of those kitchen table issues for us and for people in our community. But there's a different level of excitement and motivation that I frankly have not seen in a very long time. I have been a fairly active person in, you know, my political communities ever since I was of voting age. Back in, let's see, my first presidential election was 2008. That energy is what we're feeling now, not even in 2016, not in 2020. It feels so different. And I would say the biggest thing that feels different is in 2020, as gung-ho as I was for the Biden campaign and, you know, the change that we needed in the country, everything came from a place of fear and nervousness. If you think about the world we were living in 2020, everyone was so afraid of another 4 years of Trump. Everyone was afraid. They didn't know what was going to happen with the pandemic. And so people voted out of fear and concern. And even those, you know, days, it felt like days and days and days leading up to the results was just so much anxiety. Whereas now I feel like it's joyful. It's joyful. It's people want to volunteer. People want to get out there and participate in rallies. People want to get out there and show their support because there's something to be so actually excited about, on top of also realizing how badly we absolutely cannot have another 4 years of Trump in the White House.
I wonder where you feel this supercharged energy coming from, because your group, Motherhood for Good, is also very active on social media platforms. And I'm just wondering, is this energy coming from, you know, online? Is it in coffee shops? Is it coming from rallies? Where do you feel it?
Everywhere. I mean, certainly we started as an online account, back even from Moms for Mandela. That was the thing. Kate Duffy, our founder, started an Instagram account, just Moms for Mandela. It had a nice ring to it. And, you know, she wanted to show her support as a local mom for a candidate she truly believed in. And it truly spiraled from there in person events and partnering with the campaign and things like that. But it truly started on social media, specifically Instagram, because, you know, all the moms or people my age who have kids are on Instagram. And until recently was a fairly overlooked platform when it came to, you know, when you talk about what people were seeing in the political landscape on social media. You see a lot of what people are talking about on X, formerly Twitter. You see a lot about, you know, disinformation on Facebook, you know, even TikTok with the younger generations, which we are, you know, also getting more tuned in on TikTok. But Instagram really felt like it was kind of overlooked. But that was where, that's the social media platform that has been my primary source of, you know, social media communication, you know, for years and years and years. And it's nice to see that people actually acknowledge that this specific group of voters, this specific demographic, really do find that to be a place that they want to be and want to share information and want to interact with people. That being said, you know, we've had presence at, you know, multiple different events, even in the last, you know, during throughout the entire campaign, even before the top of the ticket change, and the energy, even at the first Harris rally, we had several members of our leadership team there, and it was electric. They said they have never felt anything like this, and we're seeing it, you know, all of the content that we're seeing shared online, but then we're also hearing anecdotally from people in our community who are going to volunteer. And they're running out of literature because they have too many volunteers coming to door knock. When has that ever happened? So yes, it is. You see the memes, you see everything online, but you're also feeling it in real life. And that is so exciting.
One last thing here. We've heard like the soccer moms helping Democrats in the 90s, the Walmart moms for Donald Trump in 2016, Panera moms for Democrats in 2018. We're hearing suburban moms. How do you feel about this, you know, trend of politically lumping and naming types of moms?
I mean, being a parent is being a part of a community, and not just a parent. We are also very clear in, while it might say motherhood for good, you do not have to be a mother to be someone who cares about our children in our society and wanting them to grow up in a world that aligns with your values. You do not need to be a mother or a parent or have any sort of connection to children biologically or through adoption or anything to be a part of our coalition. But it is something that connects a lot of us. And when you are looking for, you know, quote, mom friends, for when you go to a new daycare or something like that, there's that sense of community that you are searching for, where you have your children in common. And I think that this just adds another layer of that. You have your children in common, you have their best interests in common, and you align with this set of values and you want to do something about it. So it makes sense that you would want to be a part of a coalition that shares those values and is working towards electing officials who will make those values come to light.
Danielle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that was Danielle Scampini-Lynn of the progressive group Motherhood for Good. We talked with her about mobilizing women in this presidential election.
On Wisconsin Today, a Humane Society report shows the inspection records of dog breeders with violations and issues here in our state.
Some states are actually shutting down some of their worst puppy mills and in some cases charging the breeders with animal cruelty.
A look at regulations and dog breeders on WPR News. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Some people adopt a dog through their local shelter. Others turn to commercial breeders that operate in Wisconsin and around the country.
But how do you know if the breeder is following the law and caring for their animals in an ethical way?
An Iowa-based advocacy group called Bailing Out Benji recently published its quarterly review of violations at dog and cat breeders nationwide. According to the report, federal inspectors cited 10 Wisconsin dog breeders for regulatory violations during the second quarter of this year.
And earlier this year, the Humane Society of the United States published its annual report called The Horrible 100. That report looks into the state and federal violations by breeders. 10 Wisconsin facilities were also on that list.
Kathleen Summers is director of outreach and research for the Stop Puppy Mills campaign at the Humane Society of the United States. She works on the Horrible 100 annual report that aims to raise awareness about problematic dog breeding facilities nationwide. Kathleen, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
You use the term puppy mill. What does the Humane Society consider to be a puppy mill versus a reputable dog breeder?
Well, a reputable dog breeder will pay careful attention to the health and welfare of their breeding dogs, as well as their puppies. They breed very sparingly, and they usually keep the dogs in the home with them as you would keep your pet, with, you know, a lot of attention and quality care. Whereas a puppy mill is a large-scale commercial breeder where the dogs are usually kept in very cramped conditions, and they're bred solely to pump out puppies for the pet trade with very little care or concern for their well-being.
So really the number of puppies, the number of dogs can be a red flag, can be an indication that there certain conditions wouldn't be met if there are dozens upon dozens of puppies at a commercial facility?
That's right. We find that the larger this facility, the harder it is for the owners to keep up, even if they do have some employees. I'm sure you would understand if you have dogs at home, sometimes even two or three dogs seems like a lot. So a facility with dozens or even hundreds of dogs can be very detrimental to the animals. There just usually isn't enough space or enough personal attention for the animals to keep them happy and healthy.
To keep animals happy and healthy at these facilities, there are standards in place. There is the Animal Welfare Act. Can you talk a little bit about what are the various standards for dog sellers in the country and here in Wisconsin?
Sure. Well, the national law is called the Animal Welfare Act. It's upheld by the United States Department of Agriculture, and they do have basic rules on the amount of space each dog needs, the amount of food, and they do require that they get annual medical exams and that they have protection from the weather, this type of thing. But their rules are very basic. They're basic survival standards. But in addition, USDA only inspects breeders who sell wholesale. So that would be breeders who sell to middleman brokers, to pet stores, or online sight unseen to people who don't meet the animal before they buy them. Whereas Wisconsin and some numerous other states also have commercial kennel laws. And those laws usually also include breeders in the state who sell directly to the public.
Are breeders and brokers still in the business of selling to pet stores? I thought that was coming to an end.
So far, 8 states and more than 450 localities across the country have passed laws and ordinances to end the sale of puppies in pet stores, which encourages people to go to more humane places to buy puppies. But many states still allow it. We certainly don't recommend it because it doesn't give the buyer the opportunity to see the puppy before purchase.
Now, turning to the report that you work on, Wisconsin having 10 breeders with outstanding violations listed on your annual report called the Horrible 100. Can you talk about how do Wisconsin breeding violations compare to other states?
Well, this year we had, as you mentioned, 10 Wisconsin breeders in the Horrible 100 report. So that was 10% of the entire report. And in fact, it's more Wisconsin breeders than we've ever had in the report before. And another reason this is very concerning is we received no records from the state of Wisconsin this year. So we only had USDA records to go on. In other words, people who sell to pet stores. It's very concerning that the Department of Agriculture in Wisconsin did not send us any records. They did charge us almost $400 for the records that we requested back in February, and those records still have not arrived. So we don't know what Wisconsin's Department of Agriculture, Trade and Consumer Protection is doing as far as upholding or enforcing its law.
And so state inspectors would then go to these facilities, as would federal inspectors through the USDA. Do you know how that type of inspection works on the state and federal level?
Right. So usually at the federal level, they're inspected about once a year. But again, the USDA does not inspect as many breeders as the state would because they don't inspect breeders who sell just directly to the public. They only inspect the wholesale breeders. So there's many, many breeders who claim only to sell locally to the public, but have what Wisconsin requires, which is they sell more than 25 dogs a year. Those are the ones required to be licensed in the state. And those are the ones we have absolutely no information on because the state did not fulfill our public records request.
There are also states that you don't need to have a license to breed dogs. What could be occurring in those types of states?
Unfortunately, those states are even worse. There are states like Arkansas where we know there are many, many breeders, and only the USDA inspects there. And again, that would be only those breeders who sell wholesale. So breeders who claim to sell directly to the public in those states have no oversight whatsoever.
In looking at the maps, though, it seems like there is this cluster of licensed commercial dog breeders in the Midwest with violations. What do you see there as you look at the trends?
Well, it's very troubling because we would hope that the numbers would be going down, of course, especially with the number of years we've been putting out this report and the number of new laws that are being passed. We are seeing very big improvements in some states, but unfortunately not in Wisconsin.
What are some states doing to improve animal welfare?
Well, the public transparency is very important. We are able to get records from states like Ohio and Missouri that are known for having a lot of puppy mills, but they also are upfront about showing their records and showing how often they're inspecting and how they are citing or dealing with breeders who are not responding to getting multiple citations. So often they will, for example, in some states, if the breeder is not in compliance and that requires the inspector to go out again and do another inspection, they'll charge the breeder for that inspection because it's extra time that the state is wasting having to make rules are okay. And of course, some states are actually shutting down some of their worst puppy mills and charging, in some cases, charging the breeders with animal cruelty. Hmm. If these things are not happening, there's really no incentive for the breeders to do well by their animals because if they're getting citations and nobody sees them because the department isn't fulfilling public records requests and isn't fining or punishing bad breeders, then there's sort of a feeling among the breeding community that it doesn't really matter if they take good care of their dogs as long as they can sell a lot of puppies and make a lot of money.
We're talking with Kathleen Summers, who is Director of Outreach and Research for the Stop Puppy Mills campaign at the Humane Society of the United States, talking about the Humane Society's 2024 report of dog breeders with inspection violations. It's called The Horrible 100. Kathleen, you've been working on this report over 10 years now. Are there particular trends that emerge over time? Is it the same breeding facilities being coming up with violations over the years, or new breeders as well?
Well, there's definitely new breeders in the report every year. Every year we do note in the report if a breeder has been in the report before and how many times they've been in the report. So there's good news and bad news. We're definitely seeing every year that some of the worst breeders are being shut down. They are being fined and sometimes even sent to jail sometimes for the poor treatment of the animals. But we're also seeing that there's some breeders who are licensed by the USDA who have been in our report 6, 7, or 8 times, and they're still operating with only minor penalties. And usually in that case, it's because they were inspected so many times that they, you know, finally cleaned up enough to pass one inspection. And then the USDA says, well, you passed an inspection, so now we're going to back off a little. But we often see those same breeders will, after they've had some time, they'll go back to the old ways.
Hmm. It makes me wonder about the marketplace that they're working in, the impact of supply and demand, the impact of the economics. Is dog breeding profitable?
Dog breeding, unfortunately, can be very profitable, especially with the advent of the internet. A lot of people are able to have very professional-looking websites that show, you know, only what they want the public to see. And the public isn't really seeing what's behind those pretty pictures on the website.
And I would imagine vet care is costly. Food for the puppies also costly. Would that affect breeders as you look at the choices they would make and how they care for their dogs?
Yes. I mean, to be honest, a reputable, responsible breeder usually doesn't make much money because they're getting top quality veterinary care for their dogs. They're also screening their breeding dogs for health defects that are common in the breed before they choose to breed that dog. And of course, they are also are breeding sparingly so that they can make sure to meet every buyer and make sure that that buyer is ready to give the best home possible to that dog. So unfortunately, the breeders who are making a lot of money are often the less ethical breeders who are just breeding as many dogs as possible to sell to the, you know, the first bidder who steps forward.
Are there particular dog breeds that may be more susceptible to coming from a facility with a history of violations?
Well, puppy mills breed every kind of breed, but one thing we're seeing a lot of is the so-called designer dogs, which are mixed breed dogs. Usually there's a poodle or some type of non-shedding breed mixed in to make a labradoodle or a bernedoodle or a multi-poo. There's a lot of ways that puppy mills can exploit these dogs because they don't even have the very minimal requirement of filing paperwork with a dog registry. And often we find that the so-called doodle breeds that are being sold online, if you do a DNA test, it's often not even the type of dog that the seller claims it is.
Hmm. Kathleen, someone listening might say, I don't want to contribute to this problem. I don't want to contribute to this marketplace of this type of treatment. What would you tell prospective dog owners looking for a breeder to ensure that they are reputable and humane?
Right. Well, we would definitely encourage people to visit an animal shelter or a breed-specific rescue first and foremost. This year, the shelters are really overwhelmed with dogs, which is a very sad thing, but it does also mean that there's a greater variety of dogs in shelters than ever before. They have puppies, they have dogs of different breeds and different sizes, and that's a wonderful way to get a dog while also saving a life. But if a person does decide to go to a breeder because they're looking for a specific type of puppy, we do recommend that they go visit the breeder's home and make sure that they meet the parents of the dogs and make sure that those parents are looking happy and healthy and friendly. And you know, if when they're happy to meet you, you know that that's a well-raised dog.
I wonder how breeding facilities around the country might affect the number of dogs that could be adopted through the shelter system.
It's definitely affecting the shelters. And in fact, now for the last 2 or 3 years, shelters have really been having more and more difficulties placing dogs. And less responsible breeders and the backyard breeders are definitely having an effect on that.
Can states put more protections in place? Or you talk about transparency. Are there regulations that could bring more transparency to this aspect of breeding dogs to be sold?
Definitely. There are some states, such as Pennsylvania, for example, who put their breeder inspection reports online for everybody to see. That way, a person thinking of buying a dog can go online and see if that person has any violations.
If a puppy has had a difficult beginning, a problematic breeding facility, could that impact that dog later in life as it becomes someone's companion?
It certainly could, because those early weeks of a puppy's life, especially right when they leave the mom and their siblings, that's a very formative period for them because they're learning proper socialization. And if they're spending those formative weeks in a pet store cage or, you know, on a broker truck being delivered somewhere, they're not getting that one-on-one care that they really need to develop well psychologically.
As you work on next year's report, what is that process like? As you reach out to states, you gather your data, you do the research. What does that entail?
Well, we get as many inspection reports as we can from the USDA, which also publishes their reports online, and from every state that inspects. And we compare and contrast. We often find, for example, that some states are citing breeders who the USDA is not citing. And that is something we'll sort of call out if we see that a breeder is getting a lot of state violations, but no USDA violations. That's an indication that USDA may not be doing a very good job of inspecting. And sometimes it's vice versa. Sometimes the USDA is giving someone a lot of citations and the state is not. So that can be sort of a very interesting comparison to see who's doing their due diligence. And we do note that in the report.
Kathleen, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me on.
That is Kathleen Summers, who is Director of Outreach and Research for the Stop Puppy Mills campaign at the Humane Society of the United States. We talked with her about the Humane Society's 2024 report that aims to raise awareness about animal welfare violations and the conditions at breeding facilities. When reached out for comment about the Humane Society's request for state inspection reports, the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection said they are still working on fulfilling the records request.
Up on Wisconsin Today, communities around the state often show up on national lists of the best places to live. We'll visit two communities that have gotten national attention.
I think that Eau Claire is really one of the best places to be and to live and to visit in the whole world, and so it's an honor to have any kind of recognition.
That's coming up next here on Wisconsin Today. It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a summertime story just as the season is winding down.
Going to summer camp can be a monumental moment in a kid's life. But what if you didn't get to go to sleepaway camp as a child? Or if you were one of the lucky ones, perhaps you've been yearning for those glory days. More summer camps for adults are popping up to fill that void. Aisha Jaffer attended one in Wisconsin to see what was driving campers to pack their bags and bunk it for the weekend.
As I get older, I find it gets a little more challenging to find those carefree connections with other adults and giving myself permission to celebrate my inner child. So what better place to be a kid again than summer camp? I had never been to camp as a kid, so I decided to try it as an adult. And as I unpacked my bags at Camp Halcyon, I was whisked off to orientation where we learned about earning participation pins.
We offer buttons, little pennies, for every activity that you go to.
I talked to one of my fellow campers, Beth Haskovic, about some of the pins she's acquired so far in her time at camp.
So I have a pin. It has a bottle of champagne and a little chicken nugget that kind of looks like one of the California raisins. And so we did a pairing with chicken nuggets from McDonald's and champagne. It's really fun. We tried like a couple different champagnes, Proseccos, Cava, and ate a bunch of chicken nuggets and just got like lit.
Another pin you can earn is cookie decorating. Camp counselor Sarah Keller works at Rocket Baby Bakery in Wauwatosa and brings her talents to the table each year to teach campers this delicate art.
It's just like drawing. So you're imagining your pastry bag is like an inch and a half away from the paper, and you're going to kind of like practice on your bag a little bit.
I've earned my pin, and that's one of the new skills I'll be taking back with me when I get home from camp. But what about the childhood classics?
We did archery, which was really fun because I hadn't done it in like 20 years. I loved all the dance parties. The rave and the homecoming dance were super fun. Unless you're going to a club, like you don't really get to do in adult life.
Haskovic touches on something so true. As adults, life tends to get busy. And maybe some of us aren't at afternoon raves as much as we used to be. So why is that important? What draws people to go to an adult summer camp? To get the answer of why does this exist, why do we need this, I turn to Camp Halcyon's director, Ian Nixon, who talks about a meaningful interaction with a camper.
I was just hauling equipment, and the camper stopped me, and she said, I need to talk to you. I said, sure, what's up? And she said, this is life-changing. I've been going through a really, really hard time personally in the last few years, and I'm coming back because I didn't know I needed this, but I need it. Yeah, we've got to create these experiences for people.
Putting in the effort, that seems to be the key theme here, not only to make a great camp experience, but also in creating those new human connections. I ran into another camper who actually has had this experience time and time again.
I'm Jay Kidd. This is like my 11th Camp Halcyon. Once you come to camp, it's really like a good environment to like practice that. And you're like, wow, people really are nice. Like once you introduce yourself and you get to know them, you're like, hey, maybe the other people at work or the other people in my neighborhood or something. I can like, once you introduce yourself to them, it's like you kind of start it off. You're like, this is not as hard or as stressful as I thought it would be.
I like the notion that if we believe others want to create those connections, it might be easier to jump the hurdle of social anxiety. Also, being in the right environment, like around this campfire, might make it easier to do so.
You know, it's like a cool way to mesh with a new group of people, you know, especially after we've been in the pandemic forever and like been stuck inside, and it's just like it's a breath of fresh air.
Where are the beers?
Oh, there's some over there in like the coolers.
Oh, okay.
And that important question is evidence of a new community being built. Before leaving camp, I caught our camp director, Ian Nixon, one last time.
I want those authentic experiences, and the only way to get that is if you let go of all the outside fears and you come here and you be yourself. So I think the most important thing about coming to camp as an adult is putting yourself out there.
Welcome to camp.
Aisha Jaffer brought us that story on adult summer camp. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Wisconsin Today.
Online news outlets and financial companies often release lists of the best places to live in the United States, and Wisconsin cities often show up near the top.
Most recently, the company Smart Asset ranked Eau Claire, Appleton, and Oshkosh in their top 10 of most livable small cities in the country, while Fortune magazine ranked Middleton as the 18th best place in the U.S. for families to live.
These lists usually cite some objective metrics about cost of living, average income, and employment rates, but numbers don't tell the full story of why we love our Wisconsin communities.
So we're going to go a little deeper to get to know what makes these cities so nice to live in. We've got Emily Kuhn with us, mayor of Middleton, and Stephanie Hirsch, city manager for Eau Claire. Stephanie, welcome to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
And Emily, thanks for being with us.
It's an honor to be here.
All right. A question for both of you. I'll start with you, Emily, in Middleton. Now, I feel like if I was a mayor or a city manager and my community got mentioned on any kind of national recognition, I'd feel pretty good about it. Do you, Emily, get excited when you see Middleton showing up on, you know, Fortune or whoever's list of great places to be?
Absolutely. It is so exciting. You know, when they told us it was a great place to raise children, I was thrilled. I was like, well, I thought so. That's why we moved here.
And same question for you, Stephanie, when Eau Claire shows up at something like, you know, the Smart Asset Company's ratings of top 10 livable small cities, for example. Do you say, oh, it's just another internet thing, or no, this is actually cool?
I think it's great, and it's an affirmation of what we experience here. And because we're in a less known location than some parts of the country, everybody might not know how awesome it is in Eau Claire. But I've lived a lot of places, and I think that Eau Claire is really one of the best places to be and to live and to visit in the whole world. And so it's an honor to have any kind of recognition, and really pleased for how it reflects on our employees who work so hard and take so much pride in their work, and other community contributors.
Stephanie, let's stay in Eau Claire for a moment. Now, when these national groups do this, they pull together a bunch of statistics. It might be, you know, cost of living, amenities, that sort of thing. But when you're talking up Eau Claire to actual human beings, what kind of things do you point to back up the idea that, hey, yeah, this is a good place to live?
So we're very focused on community engagement and collecting data to try to make decisions. And so we do have an opportunity to hear from people about what they love about the city. And what they say over and over again is that it's a beautiful place to live and an easy place to live. And people love our parks and open space. And so we have 30 miles of trails within the city that connect to more than 70 miles beyond the city. And you can bike to campgrounds and state parks and diners and farms and cafes. And within the city, you can access many places as well, including unique business districts. And everywhere you go, you're biking along riverbanks and on boardwalks past murals and sculptures. And it's just such a fantastic place to be. It's easy to live here. It has the amenities of a big city, but it still has a real small town feel, and you can get out into nature in just a few minutes.
And as mayor of Middleton, Emily, what are some of the things that make you say, yeah, this is a good place to live?
Oh, I love talking about the vibrancy of this city. We have lots of businesses that are always hiring. We have a great downtown and our lake frontage. We're connecting that with the conservancy. So much like Eau Claire, you can get to one end or the other. You can go kayaking in the morning and go for a bike or run in the afternoon. And but what I did was I took a survey back in March of our homeowners and renters, and over 500 people responded. And I asked why they chose to move to Middleton, because I know why I moved to Middleton. And they said that they moved for the safe neighborhoods and the schools and the parks. And then I asked what about 20 questions later, but why did you stay in Middleton? And they said for the safe neighborhoods and the community and the parks. They also talked about walkability and being able to bike. So much like Eau Claire, it's that community focus. It's that getting out into nature. It's seeing your friends and asking them to move to Middleton. A lot of them ask their friends to move here.
We are zooming in on two communities in Wisconsin that have gotten national recognition as good places to live, rated by different standards. And we've got Stephanie Hirsch with us from Eau Claire, city manager there. Emily Kuhn with us, mayor of Middleton, talking about why their communities are good places to live. Okay, I want to talk about a challenge that's facing communities big and small: housing costs, housing availability. I just want to hear the story of how it's going in each of your communities. Emily, let's start with you as mayor of Middleton. What are the challenges, or are things going pretty well there? I don't know.
Yeah, we're a growing city, as all of Wisconsin is moving in that direction. But here in the Madison metro area, we are seeing growth rates that are just astounding. You know, every time you turn around, there are more apartments and houses being built in the county. Middleton is no different. We are running out of land space because we are growing into those other municipalities near us. So one of the challenges that we have is the last 5 years, we've been growing in a more dense manner. And you know, there are 4 and 5 story apartments going up. And when I ran for mayor, I explained to folks that if we want to stay at more of a 50-50 rate of rentals and houses, then we have to get more houses on the market. It's easy to say that we here in the metro area, there are sometimes some concerns about density and how is that going to affect my neighborhood. And so when I talked to voters at the doors, I realized that they were fine with apartments as long as it stayed on the transit corridor. And so if you focus your density towards a transit corridor where people will be hopping on the bus or taking their bike path into Middleton or into Madison, then you're going to be okay. And so what we wanted to do was pivot towards building out the houses. And so we're on track to build 150 houses this year in the city of Middleton. And in the past 5 years, I want to say it was about 50 houses total.
And Stephanie, how about housing affordability, availability, and the mix in Eau Claire?
Housing is definitely a top concern of residents. We are in a different situation from Middleton in that we are the largest city in really the upper half, the northern half of Wisconsin. So we're not a suburb of another community. We are sort of the center of gravity in north central Wisconsin. So we do have the ability to grow out, but like Middleton, the council has as its priority to have higher density housing so that we can have the amount of property and people to pay for and use amenities like stores and trails and theaters and parks, that there's basically a value that having more people together is a good thing and makes us less car dependent. So similarly to Middleton and other more kind of urban areas, we aspire to have higher density development. And we've had more multifamily housing developed recently, and partly because, or probably largely because of the cost of construction. So just the cost of construction has risen greatly, so that even building a two-family side-by-side house is $350,000, just kind of entry for the, not even a single family, but a two-family. So that's very expensive for the average household. Yeah, so we're working on it, and we're also overhauling our zoning.
Emily, I just want to get quick thoughts on a city identity in Middleton. For people who don't know, Madison and Middleton used to be pretty distinct. Well, now development has really blurred the boundaries there. Do you feel like there is a distinct Middleton identity, not just a sort of, you know, next door to Madison?
Yeah, we actually are. We have such a great business community and a vibrancy in our corridors. What we are hearing a lot from our widows who are moving to the county to help with grandkids, and they actually are choosing to live far enough away and find places and things to do. I think that a lot of times when I hear what people love about Middleton is its vibrancy. And that is the thing that we attract people. We have so many conferences and conventions that come through, and the ability to get around quickly. It's just a wonderful small town feel, and yet you're so close to so many things. It's truly a great place to live and work.
We'll leave it there. Emily, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome.
And Stephanie, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you.
Stephanie Hirsch is the city manager of Eau Claire, and Emily Kuhn is mayor of Middleton. They're with us today to look at the quality of life in their cities as both appear on online lists that rank the best places to live in the United States. Do you want to show some love to your hometown, your community? What makes it a great place to live? Tell us about it. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org. That's wisconsintoday@wpr.org. Send that in and we'll share it with other people on a future show. It's back to school time, and we want to hear from you.
Parents, are you sending a kid or kiddos back to school? Maybe it's the first day of 4K, or they just moved to college. Share your stories and your feelings with us. Email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text at 888-642-0232.
And if you're a student of any age, how are you feeling about the new school year?
And let's not leave out our teachers and school staff. What's on your mind as the year kicks off?
Again, you can email wisconsintoday@wpr.org or call or text us. The number is 888-642-0232.
Wisconsin Today is the work of a team of producers, hosts, and technical directors. Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.